And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's April 7th. 32 degrees and sunshine here in Old Town Park City. Heber City is reporting 34 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Hayes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we're waking up to a lot of sunshine, but definitely some chilly temperatures out there. So you're going to need the light jackets or a sweatshirt as you head out the door this morning due to some of those chilly temperatures. But don't worry, you won't need it all day as we are looking at that sunshine to stick around with us as we go throughout the afternoon. If you're going to be heading up to Park City today, we're looking at those high temperatures climbing into the upper 50s to near 60 for a daytime high. Over towards the Heber Valley, we've got that sunshine and high temperatures likely jumping into the mid-60s as we go throughout the day. So just some beautiful weather throughout the day with a few high clouds that'll try to increase as we get into the afternoon hours, but we'll call it mostly sunny throughout the day, so not bad at all. As we go into tonight, we will see a few more clouds, so we'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies. That'll help hold temperatures up quite a bit more from what we saw this morning. We're looking at overnight lows dropping down into the upper 30s for both the Heber Valley and in Park City. There is a slight chance, and I mean a very slight chance, of a spotty shower or sprinkle or two as we go throughout tonight and early Tuesday morning, but most of us will just be dealing with some extra clouds moving in. As we go throughout your Tuesday, high temperatures will be a few degrees cooler than where they are today, but not bad. We're talking highs in the mid to upper 50s in Park City and high temperatures in the low to mid 60s for the Heber Valley. And again, we're just going to be dealing with that very slight chance of a passing shower briefly coming on through, but again, most of us will remain on the dry side. As we get towards the middle of the work week, we've got that sunshine on the return. Temperatures starting off into the low to mid 30s. We'll be in the mid 30s there in Park City to kick off your Wednesday, with low to mid 30s to kick off the day in the Heber Valley, with high temperatures throughout the afternoon on Wednesday climbing into the mid 50s in Park City, and we should be in the mid 60s as we get into the Heber Valley. But then we've got to talk about the big high pressure ridge that builds in as we get towards the second half of the week. And that means as we go into your Thursday, that sunshine will start to warm those temperatures up quite a bit. So we kick things off in the mid 30s to start the day in both Park City and the Heber Valley. But by Thursday afternoon, we've got high temperatures jumping into the mid 60s across the Park City area as you get into the Heber Valley. How about high temperatures in the low to mid 70s? Oh yeah, now we're talking. And as we get towards your Friday, that sunshine with just a couple of high clouds building in late in the day, but overall, nice and mild temperatures. How about those temperatures climbing near 70 degrees for the Park City area, with highs climbing into the mid to upper 70s for the Heber Valley? So we've got a real nice taste of spring by the time we get towards the end of the week. But as we move into the weekend, we will start to see a few more changes. A front will begin to move our way. It'll bring us a few extra clouds on Saturday into Sunday, but right now I've got partly cloudy skies, so nothing too crazy. And there will be a slight chance of a shower by the time we get towards your Sunday. But as we look at that front ahead of the front on Saturday, we'll still be fairly mild with highs in the mid 60s to low 70s. But behind that front, we drop those highs back into the 50s. So Leslie, not too bad, but we're going up as we go throughout the next several days.
Okay. Thank you, Cedric.
Thank you.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning. So the warm weather and strong sunshine has impacted the snow surface quite a bit in the backcountry. There should be a stout crust on most aspects at lower elevations and then any sunny aspects. But that being said, there's still excellent riding and turning to be found on the shady slopes at mid and upper elevations. So you can find that today. Yesterday was pretty quiet in the backcountry. We had no new avalanches reported, though we did see evidence of a wet loose avalanche cycle on the south and west facing aspects. Today, the snowpack's generally stable. The avalanche danger is going to be low this morning with normal caution advised. The primary concerns are going to be the wet snow on steep sun-exposed slopes and lingering new snow instabilities in upper elevation shaded terrain. That said, during the early afternoon when skies are clear and temperatures peak, strong sunshine may cause the avalanche danger to rise to moderate on east, south, and west facing slopes.
Okay, Nikki, thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Summit County Sheriff's Chief Deputy Casey Bates and Public Information Officer Skylar Talbot. Heber City Manager Matt Brower will preview some of the issues with the Heber City Council. No meeting this week. And Holy Cross Ministries Executive Director Emmy Gardner with an update on some of its programs for the poor and marginalized. And Summit County, Heber City, and Holy Cross Ministries, all financial supporters of KPCW. Taking a look now at some local news, around 200 Wasatch Back residents gathered on Heber City's Main Street for an anti-Trump protest Saturday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports it was one of hundreds of similar protests across the country.
Hundreds of thousands protested across the country April 5th to stop what's being called the, quote, most brazen power grab in modern history. The over 1,000 hands-off protests were meant to call for an end to a, quote, billionaire power grab and rally against several Trump administration policies, including its handling of Social Security benefits, layoffs across the federal workforce, and anti-immigrant policies. The protests are also against Elon Musk's involvement in the federal government. Hundreds gathered on Heber's Main Street to participate in the peaceful protest. Most sported colorfully decorated signs with phrases like ban bigots, not books, save America, deport Musk, signs rules, RFK drools, and more.
Elon Musk has got to go.
Not all Wasatch Back residents agreed with the protesters. One man expressed his displeasure with the crowd, calling them idiots. Still, the protesters spoke passionately about the cause. Lainey Myers has called Utah home for most of her life and has lived in Wasatch County for about 2 years. Amid cheers and honks of support, she and two neighbors flew a large United States flag. Myers said the flag is meant to bring people together.
We all have different things to say. We all have things that are important to us that we're fighting for, but we're together and we're in unity. We're fighting together, and that's what the American flag should represent, is unity.
Meyer said she wants to fight against the Trump administration, which she said targets marginalized groups. She instead wants a government that will fight for human rights and affordable health care. Brian Schiller is from the Park City area and traveled to Heber to show his support. He flew a large pride flag at the protest and agreed everyone deserves equal rights and opportunities.
Trump is systematically discriminated against people who are different for whatever reason, and those differences should not matter. Everybody is entitled to the same rights.
A friend of Schiller's, Midway resident Donovan Simmons, attended for similar reasons. Simmons said Wasatch County is a very Republican area, and he wanted to show that there are people in the community who don't, quote, toe the line with Trump and Musk. Heber resident Laura Rubinsky held a sign that said hands off Medicare on one side and hands off Social Security on the other. She said she's scared the Trump administration will remove both programs.
The idiot in the White House, he said that he wasn't going to touch Social Security. He has lied so many times, and he still has people following him drinking that Kool-Aid. It's going to be authoritarian permanently if we don't do something now.
Rosemary Gordon has lived in Wasatch County for 5 years and said she's worried about her grandchildren's future. She's originally from Switzerland and moved to the U.S. in 1964.
When I became an American, I swore an oath to protect the Constitution and to follow the rules and laws of this country. And our current administration is not doing so, yet they swore an oath.
Gordon has lived in the U.S. for over 60 years and officially became an American citizen 7 years ago.
I needed to know that I could hold up my hand and swear an oath. Coming from Europe and having all the stories of World War II back in my mind, and my mother and father telling me stories about it, and always saying, do not hold up your hand to a flag. I had to wait until I could really truly believe that I wanted to be an American, and I do.
The crowd in Heber protested for over an hour Saturday. Other Utahns participated in hands-off protests in Salt Lake City, Logan, and St. George as well. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, I have Chief Deputy Casey Bates along with Public Information Officer Skylar Talbot. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
First off, let's just talk about with the crackdown on immigrants happening nationwide. How does that happen here locally? I mean, does the sheriff get a heads up that ICE is in the neighborhood?
The sheriff should get a heads up that ICE is in the neighborhood. We like to collaborate and be informed if they're going to come and talk to us or be in our area. So that has been the understanding. But if they do come and don't inform us, we will know really quickly if they're here because we'll receive phone calls and information about that.
Right, and I think what's important to sort of reemphasize on that, Leslie, is the sheriff's office, we've made it clear that we as a sheriff's office do not proactively enforce civil immigration law. It's something we've never done. It's something we have no intentions of doing. We're here to enforce the law, and if in the process of enforcing the law, someone who is an undocumented citizen should, you know, get arrested, that likely is going to, you know, be something that comes up later in the process as far as when they're booked into jail, things like that. ICE may become aware, you know, that they are being held at the jail. And, you know, again, if someone's committing crime and happens to get caught up in that, that's going to, you know, just be part of something they have to deal with. But again, we're not out there proactively, you know, looking for individuals who may be in the country illegally, nothing like that.
Yeah, so what type of crime then would kind of trigger the ICE and, you know, the ICE follow-up by somebody who was arrested?
So it's any criminal activity that leads to an arrest that they're going to be in the booking procedure process. And a DUI could lead to that. any crime, essentially, that will lead to an arrest that will get them booked.
Okay. You also saw some politically motivated vandalism. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, we did. Right now, it's an isolated incident, but we do want to mention it, that we had a politically motivated incident that happened to someone who was driving a Tesla. And we just want to emphasize that just because somebody is driving a vehicle, they should not be or have fear of parking in a parking lot or driving any type of vehicle. That vehicle could have been bought 4 years ago for financial or environmental reasons. And so I think it's important that we don't want to, our community is better than that, and we don't want to target people, and we're better humans than that.
Yeah, so what happened?
So the incident that the chief's speaking about, somebody had parked their car in one of the park and rides. It was a Tesla. They went to work. When they came back, they saw that somebody had marked some clearly politically motivated words or phrases into the side of their car, caused, you know, some damage, maybe using a key or something to carve those words in. I think, you know, what's really important here, and the chief touched on this, our community, we're better than that. And, you know, it says something about that this is an isolated incident. You know, when you look even across the state and especially across the country, this is a much more prevalent issue. You know, you're seeing a lot of, politically motivated incidents taking place with, you know, be it Tesla or whatever it is. And we just really want to drive the point, home that Summit County, we're better than that. You know, if someone's driving a Tesla, if you don't agree with, you know, the politics behind Tesla right now, that's certainly no reason to damage someone's vehicle. And it's criminal nature, and the sheriff's office will respond to that. We don't care what the politic, you know, motivations behind it are. It's criminal mischief, and if we find out, you know, that you're doing that, you're going to go to jail for it.
Yeah, so do we have cameras in these parking lots, or should we?
So the investigation's ongoing. A lot of Teslas and all sorts of newer cars, they do have a lot of technology where, you know, they're recording all of the time. So as when I last checked on this case, it was still active. Certainly look for, if the car had video surveillance going at the time, if the parking lot maybe had some video surveillance that they can, capture some suspects in this. At this point, though, there are no suspects.
I think it is, since it was in a park and ride, Leslie, I would encourage anybody who knows anything about this incident or if they saw anything to please contact the sheriff's office.
Okay. April is Distracted Driving Month. Any plans for this?
Well, you know, April, Distracted Driving Month, we're always enforcing the rules of the road. What we really want to do with this month is just draw awareness to distracted driving. It's so easy to become distracted driving. I've done it. I'm sure the chief has done it before. It's so easy now with technology the way it is to get drawn away from what you're doing, and it's an incredibly dangerous thing. Whether it's you're going to take a phone call or type an address into your GPS, or you've got the kids in the backseat, whatever the case. It's a problem, and that's why there's an entire month dedicated to try and really just draw awareness to it. It is a crime, right? There's state statute that says You can have your phone, certainly. There's been huge technology, advances that you really don't need to touch your phone. We have plenty of hands-free capabilities. So if you are, manipulating your phone, if you're typing in a number, you're in violation of that state statute. Further, if you commit a traffic offense and it's found that that traffic offense was because you were distracted by some other activity taking place in the car other than operating the car itself, that too, is a traffic violation in and of itself. So again, just a reminder that if you're driving, you got to dial in, you got to just drive. Get everything kind of out of your mind. If it's an emergency, pull over somewhere safe, address that, but don't be trying to, do all sorts of other things while you should be focused on the road.
Okay. Summit County has a new K-9 member. Tell us about him.
Yeah. So we have a new K-9 member, and his name is Rocket, Rocky Mountain K-9. David Kitchen with Rocky Mountain K-9 let us take Rocket, and he's a rescue from the Palisades Fire. So we have Sergeant Schaefer, who is the sergeant over our K-9 team. He's working with Rocket right now to see if Rocket is going to work for the Summit County Sheriff's Office, because he was brought to us in an unconventional way that's different from our other K-9s.
Yeah, so was he a police-trained dog, or it was just a pet?
So we're not sure, because he was found in wandering. As far as I know, he was found wandering. And so, I'm sorry, Rocky Mountain K-9 picked him up and did some work with him, contacted our K-9 and said, this might work for you guys. Let us know. And so we're working with Rocket to see if he will be a good fit for us.
Okay. He's a Belgian what?
Malinois,
yeah.
Malinois, okay.
And he'll be our seventh K-9. And so we have K-9s that specialize right now in narcotics, human trafficking. We have a bomb dog, and he would specialize in being a cadaver dog.
Yeah, so he'd kind of be the first of sort of what we hope to eventually be sort of an all-encompassing K-9 unit. Our goal is to be self-reliant, so we're not having to call upon other agencies to assist. And that's sort of the last piece to the puzzle. So we're excited to, hopefully get that up and running. As with any situation, when you're getting a new dog, there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of training, a lot of preparation, and we're still sort of in that phase right now.
Yeah, who takes care of the dog then? Somebody brings the dog home and brings it back to the office every day?
Yeah, so the person who's assigned to the K-9 lives with the K-9. That person is with the K-9 all the time to develop a relationship with the K-9, to train the K-9, because they're constantly training them. And the sheriff's office is responsible for the training.
Yeah, so what kind of equipment, if any, is the dog issued?
So it depends on what they're specializing in. Our narcotics dogs obviously are specializing. We send them to training to specialize in that, to detect. The same with the human trafficking, the human tracking. So with the cadaver dog, we're still working with that one. We'll probably train with other entities who also have cadaver dogs and see if he works.
All right, so the county then pays for...
Yes.
Vet bills, food, anything the dog might need.
Yes.
Yeah, so typically there's a stipend that that canine handler will get. That's going to cover, food, some of the maintenance. Obviously, we got to take care of these pups. So taking them to the vet, making sure they're, washed, clean, look presentable, that's all budgeted for. We really lucked out and are super appreciative of this rescue organization for, because they donated what easily could have been a $15,000 to $20,000 dog, and that was just donated to us. So we're excited and hopeful that, everything in that arena works out well for us.
Okay. Yeah. And this breed is traditionally used as a police dog. Why is that? Are they intimidating? I mean, what, are they just extra smart or?
I've never been a canine handler, and I'll just ask that the record reflect I never want to be a canine handler. It takes a very special person to do that. My understanding, though, is just their drive. They're very they have a high drive. They're traditionally a fantastic working dog. A lot of times these dogs they want a reward, and they'll work hard for a reward. Sometimes that reward is something as simple as a tennis ball. You know, so a drug dog, for example, they go out when they indicate positively on drugs, they get their tennis ball, and they'll go to the end of the world to get that tennis ball.
Yep.
Okay, I want to mention real briefly, a new SAR position, search and rescue position, opened up, and this has been taken over by Councilmember Kenneth Hart to do what?
Correct. Kenneth Hart is going to be our new search and rescue operations manager. And as we know, Kenneth was also on the board with Friends. He's been a team member with search and rescue for many years. And so we're really excited to have him on board with us as the manager helping out Lieutenant Sitaway.
Yeah, it's a super important position. I think everyone's really excited, you know, as the population grows both here, you know, in Summit County with our residents. We also, we continue to be a great recreational space for people all across the state and, you know, even nationwide and internationally. Even looking back to our calls last year, you know, 117 calls for service. Our search and rescue, they stay busy. So this position is really going to be beneficial to make sure that, you know, our folks are well-trained, continue to be well-trained, well-equipped, so that when folks, be it residents or visitors to our county, when they call on search and rescue for assistance, this is really going to amplify our ability to make sure that we can answer the call appropriately, as we've done.
Okay, just got a minute left here, but anything out of this legislative session that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, so Governor Cox has really focused on criminal justice, and there's been 43 bills that came from the legislative session that's going to affect law enforcement, from the incarceration to housing to domestic violence, overcrowding, everything. And so we're going to be having a legislative update at the sheriff's office in May for those impacts that we're going to see and the changes that we're going to see with those.
Okay, what, the Attorney General's office just sends somebody up to kind of run through them all, huh?
They do. They send, it's the prosecuting counsel, and they send up a person that comes and lets us know all of the changes, what they are, how they impact us, and
yeah,
what to do with them.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Okay.
We'll get all of our deputies in one room, and we'll have these attorneys that are specifically trained on this. They'll come in and make sure that our deputies are, you know, well aware of the changes, because, you know, we're not attorneys, and like the chief mentioned, there's a lot of information, so it's a lot to keep up on.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Skylar Talbot, Casey Bates from the Summit County Sheriff's Office. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, the Heber City Council canceled its first meeting of the month and doesn't meet again until April 15th. But on the phone to give us an update, I have City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Leslie, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. So first, just wanted to note that you had a few hundred people gathered in Heber City as part of the national hands-off protest. It sounds like things were pretty smoothly.
I think so. The chief didn't report to me anything that was contrary, so I believe it did go smoothly.
All right. So did organizers need to get a permit from the city to do this?
It depends on where the organization takes place. If they're looking at blocking a road or holding it at a city park, typically they do. As long as they don't disrupt business, sometimes they don't need a permit, however.
Yeah. And any idea? I mean, were extra police deployed for the afternoon, or...?
I don't believe so. My police chief didn't report to me that any additional precautions were taken. It was, I believe, an orderly group, and things went, very smoothly.
All right. Well, since we last talked, UDOT has come out with two new bypass routes. Has the council had a chance to discuss them?
They have not, but they will have two chances to discuss them with UDOT this week on April 9th with the Wasatch County Interlocal Meeting at 6 o'clock, and again during my regular council meeting scheduled for April 15th. The project manager, Craig Hancock, will be at both those meetings and be able to explain the final two alternatives that will be included in the draft EIS and allow my council an opportunity to ask lots of questions.
Okay. So at this point, no preferred alternative that you're aware of?
Not from my council, no.
Sure. Now, is Heber City on the line for any funding for the bypass, or is this all state money?
This is a UDOT project, so this is all state money.
Okay. Where are we with the central Heber overlay zone for the downtown area?
It was presented at my planning commission, at the city's planning commission, a couple of weeks back. The planning commission is going to, I believe, review the public input again before passing a recommendation on to my city council, which I believe will be coming before my council sometime in May.
Yeah, you did hear from neighbors who are concerned about parking and perhaps not enough parking. So can you talk to us a little bit about how that's being taken care of under this plan?
Parking is a major limiting factor with the plans we have for the downtown to transition our historic downtown into a destination. The city recognizes this and is in the process of purchasing several parcels of property. One is with the Heber Light and Power, purchasing their admin building. The second is the old fire station owned by Wasatch County. We are looking at purchasing those to provide more surface parking. Also looking at how we can provide more on-street parking and maybe approach some private partners to negotiate shared parking agreements so we can utilize their parking spaces in the evenings or on weekends. Again, we recognize that parking is a limiting factor, and we are going to do what we can to increase the number of parking in the downtown area.
So if this overlay zone is ultimately approved by the Heber City Council, what does it do?
What it does is provide some options, I believe, for existing property owners. For example, a lot of the lots in our central district are very large lots. The homes on them are very old. And what we're seeing is people wanting to do a little bit more with their property, perhaps put an accessory dwelling unit on it, perhaps put some additional parking on it. And in some cases, perhaps even transition the property into a commercial use. So the overlay zone is providing opportunities for property owners to utilize their properties potentially in different ways than they have in the past.
Right. And how would that work? I mean, if somebody went from residential to commercial, I mean, that's not what the neighbor bought into.
Yeah, so our downtown overlay zone does identify a transition to 150 East and 150 West. That has been in discussions now for several years. In the traditional central neighborhood areas, it would allow for potentially a flag lot, potentially for a accessory dwelling unit. So not necessarily commercial in these mm-hmm. traditional central areas, but for different or maybe a little bit more density of use.
Well, that's what it sounds like it's doing, allowing more density?
Limited, low density. We're not talking multifamily. We're talking, again, accessory dwelling units, things of that nature, maybe a flag lot. Again, these lots are very deep, have a lot of space on them. And quite frankly, we are in need of more affordable housing. And this, we believe, is one strategy to help achieve that.
Hmm. So would we see any exceptions to the current height limitations?
No, this particular overlay is not dealing with height, as I recall. That was decided in some previous ordinances that was adopted by council that was specific to, again, the 150 East to the 150 West area. And so I don't think we're looking at heights necessarily in the Central District Overlay Zone.
All right. Let's see. Ranked choice voting will be back. Any idea how the council is leaning here?
I don't. They will discuss this issue again at our April 15th meeting. My council is invited the public to email the city council at ccpublic@heberut.gov with their opinions and the reasons behind their opinions for either ranked choice voting or the traditional plurality voting. And so if you're interested and want to give council your feedback, I recommend your leaders send an email to my council and let them know what they think.
So what do you think? I mean, does this work better?
I'm not going to tender an opinion really on this. This is a policy issue that my council is going to make. And as a professional city manager, I will implement to my ability to the extent I can, whatever decision they come up with.
All right. I think the concern is that if they don't do it, then they kind of lose the right to do it in the future.
My council has to make a decision before May 1st, and so they are going to make that decision on April 15th. Mm-hmm. As you're aware, Park City just made that decision. We've used it for the last couple of election cycles, and so my council on the 15th will determine our 25 election cycle, whether it be the traditional methodology or whether ranked choice voting methodology.
All right. Let's see. Any action pending here on Wasatch County's request to annex about 21 acres of land into the city for the new government building?
That was recommended approval by my planning commission. We are working out a development agreement, an annexation development agreement that will come before my council, I believe, in May. And my council fully supports what the council, the county council is doing with their admin building. I fully expect that that will be approved here shortly.
So why does the county building need to be in the city limits?
It's understanding it's a state code that requires the county admin building to be located in the county seat, which in Wasatch County is Heber City. That's why it's having to be annexed.
Okay. And at the last council meeting, you heard from residents a bit concerned that the city's spending some $20 million to turn the city park into a plaza. Why does that make more sense than just taking the money and building a brand new park?
Well, the downtown has been identified as a major initiative for my city council. They want to transition the downtown into a destination where people will come to shop and dine and have activities. And the park is a key asset to achieving that initiative. And so Roger Brooks, who is a world-renowned urban planner, has identified our main park as a place to make some investments where we could then program it 250 days a year with events and activities. It's hoping that that programming of events and activities would bring locals and visitors to our downtown, and then the private investment would follow. And we believe the private investment will far exceed $23 million, and that we benefit not only from the park's renovation, but from the private investment which would take place in our downtown, improving it to become a real destination of sorts.
All right. And let's see, it looks like you'll start work on next fiscal year's budget starting this month?
We've actually been working on fiscal year 26 since December. We're slated to present a tentative budget to my council later this month in two budget workshops. The state requires us to have that budget adopted before the end of June, so we're well on track to have that done. Again, we'll present the tentative budget to my council later this month.
Okay, Matt, anything else you want to mention?
Just that Heber Market on Main, our summer concert series, will start up again on June 5th. Invite your readers and listeners to come in and enjoy the concert.
Okay, Matt Brower, Heber City Council Senior City Manager, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, the Park City School District is eliminating its chief operating officer position. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the school district announced last week that COO Mike Tanner will no longer be with the school district.
The COO position was first created in 2019 when Jill Gilday was superintendent. Michael Tanner has held the role for the past 6 years. The district announced April 3rd it has eliminated the position, saying it's part of restructuring administrative roles. Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman was appointed in January. The district said one of the first tasks she took on was assessing the administrative structure of the district to determine what positions could be cut to reduce administrative overhead costs. The district said in a statement, quote, "This is consistent with an overall trend of declining enrollment and planned school consolidation that includes the closure of Treasure Mountain Junior High at the end of the 2024-25 school year." Tanner was notified his position would be eliminated effective March 31st. Tanner's COO and special assignment duties for safety and security have been reassigned to other district administrators. The district said Tanner will be available as needed through June 30th, 2025 to assist in the transition. This change comes on the heels of an external investigation the district requested after receiving questions and concerns about Tanner's salary and district duties. Huntsman said on KPCW's Local News Hour March 20th, the district investigation had ended but would not speak to specifics of the investigation or the findings. According to the job description, the COO is the second in command of all district functions after the superintendent. The position was responsible for forming and communicating safety policies and procedures, managing all district construction projects, and heading the transportation department. Documents KPCW obtained from the district state Tanner's starting COO salary was over $129,000 in 2019. Along with Tanner's COO responsibilities, he received a special assignment or extra duty contract. In 2019, the additional $55,000 contract was for safety responsibilities, which is seemingly already part of the COO job description. Tanner earned a total of $185,000 in wages and benefits that year. However, this doesn't align with the state auditor's transparent Utah numbers. The website shows in 2019, Tanner earned over $45,500 in wages and benefits. Both contracts were renewed yearly with increases. By fiscal year 2024, the special assignment contract had increased by over $21,000, totaling more than $73,000 for that year. According to Transparent Utah, Tanner's total wages and benefits increased by almost $60,000 from fiscal year 2020 to fiscal year 2024, totaling almost $360,000 last year. Concerns were also raised about the second highest person in the district working remotely while overseeing safety procedures and construction projects. In the statement, the district thanked Tanner for his 6 years of service, including COVID-19 challenges, district construction projects, and security initiatives. See the district's full statement at kpcw.org. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
June marks the 150th anniversary of the Sisters of the Holy Cross arriving here in the state of Utah. In the studio to tell us a little bit about how they plan to celebrate the sesquicentennial is the Executive Director of Holy Cross Ministries, Emmy Garner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's just start with the origin of Holy Cross Ministries. I had no idea it had so much history to it.
Yeah, it totally does. I mean, you think about why would a congregation of Catholic nuns come out to, you know, newly established, very Mormon LDS Utah, right? And Bishop Scanlon back then asked them to come out because he had heard about them being Navy nurses because they had helped during the Civil War, and so asked them to come out to build. And within 6 months, Leslie, they built a hospital and they built a school. And so, I mean, you talk about industrious and just incredibly kind of social justice driven women. I mean, it's been that legacy for the last 150 years.
Yeah, and even a long history of the nuns right here in Park City. Of course, we've got St. Mary's Church, but then there was a school that I read that started in 1882, and that's like 2 years before the town even incorporated.
Exactly. And they were very big. They're big proponents both on health and on education, really feeling like education and knowledge empowered folks. And so very strongly, those were their two main focuses, right? And over that 150 years, what's been amazing is there were over 1,300 Catholic sisters that did some level of ministry here in Park City, in the broader Utah. They were down in Richfield helping migrant workers when there were issues with, you know, miscarriages because they weren't getting maternal, you know, they weren't getting prenatal care. I mean, again, they were just always about identifying a need and responding in solidarity to meet it with the underserved population.
Yeah, so 1,300 sisters at its height. What are we down to now?
Oh my gosh, it's such a bittersweet story. We are now down with many of the sisters having retired. We have three Holy Cross sisters here in the state of Utah now. One down at St. Therese, who also works for Latino Behavioral Health, and then the other two are educators, and so one works at St. John's and the other at St. Anne's, which is also the school now, but was also an orphanage that the sisters built.
And I had no idea. That's that gorgeous building there.
Yes.
On State 2100 South.
Correct, in Fifth East, exactly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so so an orphanage for many years then, huh?
And it was an interesting thing. So again, for the minors, what would happen is if a, you know, sometimes they would say it wasn't an orphanage as in orphan kids there, but it was like a boarding school almost, mm-hmm. because as the miners were busy and in the mines, the kids would stay there. Or if, you know, the wife died and the husband's still working, the kids would be there, but then they'd go back with dad on the weekends, that kind of thing. So it was, again, a need that they identified as they were working with the miners, and so they built that orphanage, and it's now been transformed to an elementary school.
Okay. So did nuns serve as nurses and midwives as we saw them, you know, like in England?
Yes.
Yeah.
All levels of care for the sisters. I mean, they had two hospitals, Holy Cross on South Temple and then Holy Cross Jordan Valley. And throughout that, we had sisters in all various levels, health administration, chaplaincy, nursing, a variety of roles. Yes.
Yeah. So over that last 150 years, I mean, has the mission of this organization, I mean, because it wasn't until, I think, the 90s that Holy Cross Ministries was actually formed.
Right, but- right. So the mission has not changed, Leslie. That's a great question. What happened is when the sisters decided that they couldn't compete with the big health systems like the U and Intermountain that were integrated, they sold the hospitals. And the money from that sale is what founded Holy Cross Ministries 30 years ago. So in that context, I mean, it was still continuing that social justice mission of identifying the underserved population and doing all that we can to help them, you know, thrive and gain and, you know, get to self-sufficiency. Yeah.
Yeah. And why, I mean, just that's not something women choose to do anymore, is go into the becoming a nun?
I guess not. It's just not like not a life commitment people want to make. And yet I think, you know, we say, I mean, all of us now, I mean, as, you know, we haven't taken vows of, you know, like the sisters did for life commitment, but everyone there, I mean, I think we really resonate with that mission, and it's say like it's really our obligation now to maintain that legacy, right? And to be the ones to continue that commitment to helping the underserved.
All right, so anything special planned for the anniversary?
Yes, definitely. We're going to be doing a big 150th anniversary in October, that first Saturday of October. And what's really cool, Leslie, is the current president for the congregation, they don't call them Mother Superiors anymore, is Sister Charlotte. And Sister Charlotte was actually the person who founded the immigration program at Holy Cross Ministries. She actually happens to also be an immigration attorney, right? So she'll be coming out to be our keynote speaker and to kind of speak of that 150-year legacy of the sisters, spent quite a bit of years out here in Utah, but like I said, is now leading this international congregation that's in 7 countries on 4 continents. So yeah, we're super excited to have her come out.
Okay, and you do have that timeline online, so if
yes.
people are interested, it was pretty interesting to,
yeah.
to kind of go through. Ministry has also started what you're calling the 1875 Club. What's this do?
Well, we're hoping to get, you know, similar to like, you know, NPR and such, like sustainers, if you will. And so it's that idea of, especially now as we're, you know, we, like many other nonprofits, are concerned about cuts in funding, right, and the federal changes and all the executive orders, it would allow us to build a cohort of folks where we know we can count on monthly, you know, monthly donations coming in so that we know what that baseline is. And so really, I think we feel now more than ever, like I said, with the attacks on nonprofits, that if we could get more folks into our 1875 Club, one, that's honoring the amazing legacy of the sisters, but two, it's continuing to support Holy Cross, which is their continued, you know, ministry going forward.
Now, immigrants without legal status are getting a bad rap these days. I mean, is that impacting your fundraising? Are people not wanting to help those who may not be here in the country legally?
You know, we don't hear as much about that, Leslie, as an organization in terms of like, you know, just hardcore attacks for us. But what we do, like I say, what we do see, you know, we have a grant that was helping green card holders become citizens. It was called the Utah Citizenship Initiative. We just heard on Friday that the federal funding through USCIS was cut. However, again, Utah being Utah, this is money out of the Governor's Office of Economic Opportunity, reapportioned monies so that we could continue to complete that grant cycle, right? Because again, their commitment is we have over 50,000 folks who are eligible to become citizens here. So we really want to be able to encourage folks to get their citizenship, right? So we have been fortunate, unlike other entities where they've, you know, like we just heard about public health and other, and like SAMHSA funding being cut and things like that. We have not experienced that as yet, but we're preparing for that. And so that's again why the 1875 Club, why other things, we're really just trying to anticipate and be planful so that we can sustain our existence to continue to support the immigrant community.
Yeah. So is that enough funding then to get these 50,000 through the process?
Yes. It's the funding that they match the funding that the federal dollars took away. But again, that grant ends in December. Will we get all 50,000 done by then? No. So could we continue? I think we were hoping for a renewal, and that's not going to happen. So again, another reason to, if people are interested and invested in that, for sure.
Okay, let's just talk about 2024 in terms of the how many people Holy Cross Ministry did serve, quite a few.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw over a 7% increase in the amount of clients that we served, kind of close to, in terms of unique individuals, right? Nearly 4,600 folks, right? And of those folks, I mean, the vast majority, 62% were women, 12% are littles, are under 18, right? 75% uninsured, right? And and nearly 70% living in poverty, so at that poverty AMI, right? Again, but I think the piece I want to emphasize is that these are really hardworking families that are really trying to just make a better life for themselves, that are really contributing members. Many are either mixed status, and that's part of why they're underinsured or uninsured. But again, they're here. They're a part of our community. They're our family, our neighbors, our friends, and they want to make a difference.
Yeah, and what is it do you think they need help with most?
It for us, what we've seen since the election is a lot of knowledge, Leslie, and education to clear out the misinformation, right? The president makes executive orders. Some are within his role to do, many are not, right? And so quelling the fear and anxiety of, yes, we know he said that, but a court is gonna stop that. Yes, we know he said this, but no, he doesn't have the authority to. So part of it is really we're doing all of these outreach efforts with our legal team, just trying to help our immigrant community understand how the federal actions are impacting them locally.
Yeah, and you actually do have a legal immigration team, huh?
We totally do. We have two attorneys, a paralegal, and five what are called Department of Justice accredited reps. You know, and right now what we've just seen since, again, the election is this insane influx of calls, of questions. Our legal team, I mean, we're the largest what's called U visa provider, which means we are helping folks that are victims of crime, primarily domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking. We do over 25 comprehensive consultations a week. But in addition to that, what we've seen in the last 3 or 4 months is our phone ringing off the hook and doing a variety of screenings of kind of mini consultations, if you will, and outreach efforts into schools and through the Latinx Stake Center from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so we're pushing, you know, into the 70s a week of just families calling, asking for information and knowledge, right? Trying to help them understand their unique situation.
And I know another one of the big programs that you do here in the Park City area is your school readiness program. That continues?
Yes, school readiness does continue, although again, with some of the craziness at the federal level, I think some of our families were a bit concerned just given the what country they came from and what temporary protective status has been approved and what's been denied. I mean, just out of confidentiality for our families, but a concern that, you know, are they going to have to leave the program? Or as some are looking at what they call voluntarily deporting themselves so that they don't have their families kind of broken up. And so, again, I think for us, it is trying to manage that fear, reinforce and support folks and help them know that they're safe and that they're welcome here.
Okay. Any other programs, highlights that you wanted to
Yeah, the other about? Thing I just wanted to share too is, you know, we love partnering with all of our collaborative nonprofits up here in Park City, and we've had a bit of a restructure just with some transitions and positions, but we are excited to start next month with a therapist back up at People's Health Clinic and at Peace House, and then also we're super grateful to both the Rotary as well as the Park City Municipal for helping us fund, and we're going to be hiring a doula and putting that doula up in People's Health Clinic too. So again, our health pillar kind of reactivating, where we've been doing so much work in the legal realm. Our DOJs still come up here and do screenings for the residents at you know, Peace House on a monthly basis. So just again, I think people, yes, know us by the cute littles. We love that. And all of our education outreach, but know that we're doing health and immigration up here as well. So the full scope of our organization.
Okay. People can get more information or support your work, hcmutah.org.
Yes.
Anything else, Emmy?
No, just okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Icon Pass holders will be able to visit a new Canadian ski resort starting next season. Le Massif de Charlevoix in Quebec is known for its more than 2,500 feet of vertical drop with 8 chairlifts and 53 ski runs. It's Icon's 11th Canadian resort and 3rd on the eastern side of the country, joining Tremblant and Blue Mountain. Icon Pass holders will have 7-day access to Le Massif with no blackout dates. Icon Base Pass holders will have 5-day access with select blackout dates beginning with next ski season. The Icon Pass is now available. Prices increase after April 17th. The Epic Pass price goes up April 13th.